Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
It's one of the most dreaded words your doctor could utter, cancer. But now, thanks to decades of research, more and more cancer patients are becoming cancer survivors and going on to lead long, healthy lives. I'm Maylilly Lee. Thanks for joining us. This year, more than 1.5 million people in the U.S. will be told they have cancer. That, according to the American Cancer Society. About a third of those patients will die from the disease. Cancer remains the second cause of death in America, accounting for 1 in every 4 deaths. As grim as those statistics sound, cancer treatment is improving thanks to genetic research and personalized treatments. It used to be everyone with a specific type and stage of cancer was given the same course of treatment, but that's changed. Today, we'll discuss personalized medicine as it relates to cancer treatment. Joining us are two people on the front lines in the field. Joining us from her office in Charlottesville is Dr. Susan Modisett. She is the director of the Gynecologic Oncology Division at the University of Virginia Health System, co-director of the High-Risk Breast Ovarian Cancer Clinic, and a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UVA. And joining us from the Richmond studio is Anne Dusing. She's the treatment team chair of the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia, as well as the outreach librarian of the UVA Health Sciences Library, based at UVA's College in Wise. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Modisett, I'd like to start with you. You've been at UVA since 2006, but not really, because it's your alma mater.
Right. Yes, I was a medical student here. And then left for all my training and was on faculty elsewhere, but took the opportunity as soon as it presented itself to come home.
And tell me about your work there now.
So I am, as you said, the division director for GYN Oncology, and, you know, it's a field dedicated to women's cancers. And our mission is to eradicate women's cancers. We primarily treat ovarian, uterine, cervical cancer. I also do a lot of work with breast cancer patients because of the link between ovarian cancer and breast cancer. So that's why we run the High-Risk Breast and Ovarian Cancer Clinic, to try and identify high-risk women before they develop cancer and to prevent it.
And can you tell me, Anne, about the mission of the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia? And where are you based, by the way?
I'm based at UVA's College at Wise. I actually work directly for the Health Sciences Library in Charlottesville, but it's an outreach position that was developed almost 20 years ago, and I've been serving in that position all that time.
And yet the CAC is statewide.
It is. It is definitely. And it's a privilege to be able to work with our local cancer coalition and then be involved statewide. And the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia, also known as CACV, was established back in 1998, and it's evolved over the years. And it's now a 501c3 organization, and it focuses on eliminating preventable cancers and minimizing the burden of cancer in Virginia. And we have partners from all across the Commonwealth. Our members include not-for-profit organizations, academic institutions, public health agencies, government offices, community-based organizations, individuals, and healthcare organizations. And we have an executive board, and then we have our general membership, and we have action teams. And all of those action teams include prevention, early detection, survivorship. And the one that I focus with generally is the treatment team, and I've served as chair for several years. And we have a new cancer plan that was just rolled out recently. It'll cover until 2017, and we have specific goals and objectives that we're trying to reach. And the treatment team is focusing on an objective of connecting Virginians with information and access to innovative and evidence-based cancer treatments.
Could I interrupt you there?
Sure.
So if I'm a cancer patient, would I be able to have direct contact with the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia? Or is it more for caregivers and decision makers?
No, it's for anyone who is interested in cancer issues across the state and is interested in becoming a member, and they can serve on a team. Each member chooses a team to work with. There's an application form. It's on our website.
And what is that address?
It is cancercoalitionofvirginia.org.
All of the addresses that we name on the show will also show up on virginiapublicradio.org at the Virginia Conversations website as well. So people don't have to stop their cars and write down the website, but that will be great. Let's turn now to one of our callers. Dr. Mark Kochendorfer is with the Blue Ridge Cancer Center, and Dr. Kochendorfer, we want to talk to you a little bit about the research that you've been involved in, especially since there is a patient we'll be connecting with later on who has benefited from Herceptin research. Hi, how are you doing?
Oh, good. How are you?
Just
Thanks
great.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. In fact, what I'd like to do, if we can go ahead and coordinate both lines, is let's have Sharon Rappaport on as well. She is a breast cancer survivor, and you have taken part in clinical trials relating to this research. Hi, Sharon. Great to have you with us.
Hi.
Hi there. Now, can you hear the doctor clearly enough?
Hello,
when he
doctor.
Chimed in? Well, yes.
Hello?
Well, I'll tell you what. There, here's his voice right here.
Yes, I can hear him. Thank you.
All right. Now, if you could explain the research that you're doing, that would set us up, and we'll talk a little bit about Sharon's experience with this.
Well, sure. You know, I think I was asked to come on here because of one of my patients that has a specific type of breast cancer. You know, like has already been mentioned, 15 years ago, we were treating all breast cancers the same. You know, they received chemotherapy, which are drugs that basically try to kill fast-growing cells, since cancer has no simple form of cells in your body that are mutated and grown uncontrollably. Well, it was noticed along the way that there was a particularly bad mutation as we started to look at this at breast cancer at the genetic level called HER2, and these patients tended to do very poorly. What happened along the way was that a protein called an antibody, which there's billions of them in your body, basically that fight infection, was manufactured that targets the HER2 receptor on the cancer cells. And giving this in conjunction with chemotherapy increased our response rate, and in the curative setting where the cancer can be resected completely, the cure rates of patients with this very bad type of breast cancer.
That has
been a huge step forward for us.
And Sharon, you were not that particular patient to whom the doctor is referring. However, you have really benefited from this personalized medicine approach.
Yes. I was actually diagnosed with breast cancer in the early 2000s. I was living in New York City at the time, and it was a very aggressive cancer. And I had the kind of cancer that the doctor just described, which made me eligible for the drug Herceptin. At that time, Herceptin was just opening a phase 3 clinical trial to use Herceptin on women in the adjunct setting, which basically meant that they had used it on women with metastatic cancers before that, but they wanted to see, because they'd had so much success there, how it would affect women who were still in earlier phases of the disease. And I had a stage 3, so it was very personalized for me because the first doctor that I had didn't even suggest Herceptin. I kind of did my own personal research on it and found out about it, and I went on a search to put myself on that trial, and I found at that time there was only one hospital in New York City that had the trial open. So I switched hospitals and doctors in order to get on the trial. I was eligible. And it was a fantastic thing because every doctor I've seen since then has convinced that drug saved my life. It really is quite an amazing drug.
Dr. Kochendorfer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doubled the cure rate. I was actually involved in that trial. It was incredible. When they presented the actual results at the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting in 2005, everybody's jaw just dropped, and yeah. everyone just stood up and gave it a standing ovation. It was such an incredible move forward for us, because we've seen so many of these patients die from their breast cancer.
And you notice that Sharon talks about going online and researching many things on her own. That seems like mm-hmm. a double-edged sword for a doctor. You've got patients who have a lot of information, many of which have maybe misinformation, and then others are armed with, oh, just the right information. How does that feel as a doctor when we pair our patient advocacy with what we find online?
Well, I think it's great when the patients, you know, seek information, and I think obviously I agree with all the other doctors that have talked with Sharon that it probably helped her tremendously. I think it's just the reality now. There's a lot of information out there. I would just suggest to anybody who's listening to stick to the, you know, to reputable websites and not, you know, websites. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. You know, things like the National Cancer Institute, WebMD, American Society of Clinical Oncology, you know, all of these types of places really have vetted solid information that's not going to mislead you.
And where are we in Sharon's timeline? I know that after you have beat the cancer, for lack of a better word, a certain number of years pass and you have a really good chance of not having any secondary cancers or a recurrence.
I'm 12 years out from diagnosis.
Doctor?
Yeah, her chance, she would be considered cured at this point. I mean, the
Wonderful.
Chances of that cancer coming back are exceedingly small. In fact, with the HER2-positive cancers, you know, I don't know what her estrogen receptor status was, but typically if they don't recur in 5 years, you can be considered cured of that type of breast cancer. That's a little
Outstanding.
Different from other types of breast cancer, but these, if they come back, they usually come back early and very strongly.
And that's Dr. Mark Kuchendurfer with Blue Ridge Cancer Care. Thank you so much for sharing your insight. And Sharon Rappaport, thank you so much for calling today. Both of you, welcome guests.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now let's go back to Susan and Anne. I do want to talk with you a little bit, Susan, about what you just heard and your insight into that. It seems, I don't know if other listeners were feeling this, but lucky patient. Lucky patient. She found just the right clinical trials for her.
At the right time. And so I want to go back a little bit to the personalized medicine, because I think that is a word that gets thrown around a lot. And it means different things to different people. We've always personalized cancer care in that we, back in the day, could just look under the microscope to see what the cancer looked like under the microscope. And for example, with ovarian cancer, we didn't treat every ovarian cancer the same. There were certain characteristics that were treated one way and another way. And so now with the advent of genetic sequencing of the cancers, as well as genetic sequencing of the patient's non-cancer cells, we've introduced a whole other level upon which we can personalize care. And that opens a whole new can of worms. One of the things that was brought up are the importance of clinical trials. And we run a lot of clinical trials here at UVA, and the hard part is for rare cancers, for rare mutations, it's really hard to pinpoint for each cancer what's the driving force on the unrestricted growth. How can you interrupt that? And the worst part about it is there's so much redundancy built into the system that even if you block one pathway for the cancer to grow, it very often figures out another way around it. So it becomes really hard to figure out what the driving force of each individual cancer is, if that makes sense. Her trial was great. That was one of the home runs. We have some other first base hits, I would guess, if we're going to go on a baseball analogy, where we found things that help for a short amount of time in terms of treatment and response, but haven't been quite the home run in terms of cures.
So are we saying that the home runs are rarer?
Yes, they are, because, again, there's just so many different avenues that can be investigated. But, again, the more information we find out, the more we're able to kind of tailor things, add additional drugs on, block the pathways in multiple different ways, so you're not just relying on one block.
That's Dr. Susan Modisett of UVA. And also joining us is Anne Dusing. She is the treatment team chair of the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia. You noticed, Anne, that Sharon brought up her own research. What about patients who feel that they just don't have adequate resources, they don't know where to turn,
Well, as you may or may not know from my introduction, I am an outreach health sciences librarian. So there are lots of resources out there. And as the doctor mentioned previously, there can be lots of things on the web, but you need to find quality resources to utilize. And a couple that might be included and added to the ones he mentioned are Medline from the National Library of Medicine, which is perhaps a more clinical research-oriented database, but has journal articles that are truly vetted, include lots of evidence-based medicine, and that's searchable by anyone at pubmed.org. And then there's also another arm of that resource from the National Institute of Health and the National Library of Medicine called Medline Plus, and that's more consumer-patient-oriented. But everyone in the community should know that they can also get in touch with health sciences librarians at medical centers, at cancer centers, and even at their public libraries if they need some assistance and they're searching so that they're sure they're getting good quality resources.
All right. Yes, go ahead.
Resource I just want to mention, for particularly for clinical trials, is that every clinical trial in the United States pretty much now has to be registered on clinicaltrials.gov. And so this is,
yes,
I think, an easier place for patients to look. Medline is great, but it gives you the individual journal articles, which are sometimes, I think, really difficult for some patients to decipher. But the clinicaltrials.gov will list all of the trials, where they are open. And it's also somewhat difficult to navigate, but these are things that patients can look up and then take to their doctors and say, hey, what about this? Does this make sense for me? Does this not make sense for me? Because, again, it is difficult to parse out. Would you be eligible? Is this particular trial applicable to your tumor type? Because, again, a lot of stuff gets on USA Today or gets on the news, and people just aren't able to get enough information to know whether it applies to them or not.
Right. A patient might hear about a breakthrough in ovarian cancer, but that has nothing to do with skin cancer or vice versa. In fact, when you and I spoke earlier, Doctor, you stressed the importance of clinical trials and how important it is to flesh out the vital questions.
Oh, I just can't stress enough the role that clinical trials has played in cancer care. And, you know, over the last 30 years, we have developed cures, for example, for some of the pediatric tumors, which are just heartbreaking as a parent. That, to me, is the worst thing that could ever happen. But pediatric tumors, some of the ovarian germ cell tumors have developed cures based on clinical trials. And without clinical trials, we really can't know if a new treatment is better than what we've been using before. Because you can't just take one person's phenomenal response to something and say it's going to work for everyone. So you really need a rigorous system for doing that. And it, unfortunately, is really difficult to run clinical trials. It costs, for an institution, $8,000 to put a patient on a clinical trial.
Wow, that is really costly. And we're going to continue with that conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. More with Dr. Susan Modisett and with Ann Dusing. Next week, Historic Garden Week in Virginia. And we'll be answering your garden questions on the next Virginia Conversations. We usually get a flood of calls about that. Stay with us. We'll have more on personalized cancer treatment in just a moment. Today we're discussing personalized cancer care based on the genetic makeup of the patient and their tumor. Guests are Ann Dusing with the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia and Dr. Susan Modisett, professor and cancer researcher at UVA. First thing I want to do right out of the gate, Dr. Modisett, is talk about how personalized medicine is different, but not, because I really want to introduce that concept around our awareness of genetic markers around cancer treatment.
Okay. Kind of using an example from my area with ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer affects 25,000 women a year in the U.S. And most of those, we don't really know why women develop it. But there's a subset that is inherited, meaning that they are born with a mutation in a tumor suppressor gene. And so these are called BRCA genes. And these women's cancers react differently to certain chemotherapies. And, for example, one of the new personalized therapies that would be coming out is a group of drugs called PARP inhibitors that impact how DNA is repaired. And so, for example, women with these BRCA mutations, we have trials ongoing currently that add our traditional chemotherapies plus actually a targeted antibody plus one of these PARP inhibitors. And this is a phase one trial that's being run nationwide looking at this question. And so that's one example of where we're combining our traditional treatments with some of these new targeted ones to see if we can improve outcomes.
And many people look to the genetics. We see Angelina Jolie, mm-hmm. who has had two surgeries at least relating to her own genetic markers.
And I applaud her for going public with such a personalized decision on what to do. And that's part of our focus. So when I have a family that has one of these mutations, it's horrible that they have a mutation, but in some ways, I hate to say this, is wonderful because I know exactly what their risk of developing these cancers are. I can tailor screening for certain of the cancers that they are at risk for. For example, these BRCA mutations are at risk for breast cancer, also ovarian cancer, also pancreatic cancer, also melanoma. So it's not just breast cancer, although breast cancer somewhat rightfully does get all of the press. And then so not only can we screen more intensively to try and find a cancer early, we can also introduce risk reduction measures to prevent a cancer, for example, blocking some of the estrogen receptors. We can also then go as far as to promote surgeries where we remove the fallopian tubes and the ovaries to prevent ovarian cancer, and we can remove the breasts if necessary as well to prevent breast cancer. So these are all things we can do to prevent the cancer, and it's always, I can't stress this enough, better to prevent it than to try and cure it.
And yet we want to stress that despite the knowledge we have around genetics, we shouldn't underestimate obesity, diet, and other factors.
Oh, yeah, that's the other area close to my heart is obesity-related cancers. And one of the striking things is that if we, as a society, could manage to promote diet and exercise such that most of us were near a normal weight, we would prevent one-fifth of cancer deaths in women. I know more about women than men, sadly, but
that's an amazing statistic.
Yeah, there are a lot of very heavily obesity-related cancers, particularly postmenopausal breast cancer, colon cancer, and endometrial cancer, which is cancer of the lining of the uterus. And these are all of them in the top four incidence of cancers in women.
Later, I hope that you will be able to help flesh out the two treatments that you focus on, breast cancer and ovarian cancer. Before we do that, I do want to take this call from a current lung cancer patient, Stephanie Dunn-Haney. We welcome you to the program, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Where are you calling from?
I am calling from Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania.
And can you give us a brief history on where you are with your lung cancer?
Sure. I was diagnosed in October of 2007 with stage 4 lung cancer, and have just been very fortunate that I have had therapies that have worked very well for me to keep my disease stable. It's not as if it's gone away or I've gone into remission, so to speak, but it's controlled my disease.
And share with us what your treatment process was and your relationship with your cancer doctor.
I started with the traditional chemotherapy that has kind of the expected side effects, which was very, very difficult. And yet, at the same time, I had an appreciation for how much better it was than it must have been 20 years ago. And then went on a targeted therapy for a mutation, interestingly enough, that I didn't have, but it worked for almost 3 years. And then went into a clinical trial with a drug that also kept it stable for a gene mutation that I do have, and that worked for nearly 3 years, a little bit less than 3 years. Then I started to, we found some growth in my brain, so because this drug wasn't known to cross into the brain, changed to a different clinical trial, and so I started that about 3 months ago, and it appears things are stable on that. But so the last 3+ years have been in clinical trials for a marker that I have. So I really have kind of two doctors. I have the doctor that I found to direct my care early on, who I was very deliberate about finding the right doctor, and he was great. He said to me, we can manage this disease. You know, it doesn't have to be curable. Was really supportive, so he was really the right doctor for me.
That's great.
And in my clinical trials, I go to Fox Chase Cancer Center, have a doctor there. So as needed, I kind of go back and forth and have relationships at two places.
Gosh, Stephanie, we really appreciate your insight and sharing your story. Best of luck to you in your continued treatment.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. We have a call from Charlottesville now from Peter. Peter, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I just wanted to share a story that touched my family, advocate for what a comment you had made earlier, or the librarian from the Health Science Library had made earlier about getting good information to patients about their treatment. So an aunt of mine, unfortunately, came down with non-small cell lung cancer about a year ago. And faced with that diagnosis and reading online, found out from what she was reading that, you know, the life expectancy for this cancer is very poor, only a few months. And faced with that decision, she almost decided to forego treatment, to forego any further characterization of her cancer, any further investigation because of the fear of chemotherapy and kind of the sense of futility that she had from it. But what happened and what I was able to help her with was that actually getting in touch with a librarian and getting her good, accurate, up-to-date information about the type of cancer she had, we were able to say, okay, well, it's not small cell. Yes, it has a poor prognosis, but there are, you know, there are these mutations that have been identified. There are these drugs that have come out recently and there are these clinical trials going on. And luckily, it turned out that she had a ALK-positive mutation, and therefore she was eligible for the drug crizotinib, one of the new tyrosine kinase inhibitors that had been approved no less than, I think it was 18 months prior. And she's been on this drug with no side effects for nearly a year now. So she's quadrupled the life expectancy for the type of cancer she has.
What a good story. And how
good information from a librarian.
Yeah. And how old is your aunt, Peter, roughly?
She's in her 60s.
Wonderful. What a great story, and we appreciate your sharing that. I'm going to turn to Anne. A lot of people don't think to turn to a librarian for help with cancer issues. That's a great outcome.
Sure, and more hospitals and even public libraries have had a focus on health interest and interest in knowing that they can help out their local communities. And if people can go to the web pages for the hospital or the medical center where they are, they can frequently find the contact information, and there are frequently outreach people like me who are available to help with searching.
And you wear a couple of different hats. One is as outreach librarian of the UVA Health Sciences Library based at UVA's College in Wise. Is there a way to get a hold of you?
Absolutely.
Okay, how would that be?
You can reach me at my email address, which is cad4n@virginiaspelledout.edu.
Great. And we'll have that on our Virginia Public Radio website for Virginia Conversations as well. We're talking with Anne Dusing. She's the treatment team chair of the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia, and Dr. Susan Modisett of UVA. Hi, Shannon. You are from Richmond, and you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. I was just hoping that the guest could mention briefly, I recently finished a research paper that I started because a number of people that I know and friends of family have come down with various forms of cancer, and I just wanted to become a little bit more informed. And I was looking into high-dose intravenous vitamin C therapy, and your guests are talking a lot about clinical trials and how beneficial those are, and I was able to find a number of clinical trials, but it seems that this particular therapy, which may or may not be an end cure, but which is from the research that I was doing seems like a really beneficial and hugely helpful treatment is kind of largely ignored. I was hoping that you might be able to speak to that or talk about it or
yeah, thank you,
why
Shannon.
That is.
We appreciate that. Let's go ahead and turn to Dr. Modisett.
Great.
I'll take my offer.
So a couple things I will just say. A lot of times various research will start off with a small study that in very few patients and might show some beneficial effects. But then research later on with larger numbers, with greater people, does not confirm that. I will be the first to say that I'm not an expert on vitamin C, so I can't speak primarily to that. But a lot of times things get started somewhere, then the more research haven't shown it to be as beneficial. And sometimes even these vitamins or these cures that are promoted sometimes can counteract other drugs, so you always have to be careful. We love vitamin C. It is a great thing, but sometimes those are high-dose vitamin E or high-dose iron. There have been a whole lot of various high-dose vitamins can be helpful, but sometimes it can actually counteract other things. So it's not that we probably ignored it. My guess is that at least I know, for example, in ovarian cancer, it has not been shown to be beneficial. I can't speak to some of the other cancers. I don't know what you found in your research. But again, that's what sometimes happens is you get a very promising start on something and it looks good, and then you find out either it only works for a very small number of people or it can't be replicated. And that's kind of the thing about science is you have to be able to prove it and compare it against either standard or care or a placebo to make sure it, in fact, made a difference. For example, some people that go on hospice actually live longer than people that get chemotherapy. Because we've taken away some of the toxicities and things associated with treatment. So it's always really, you have to be really careful assigning attribution to a trial or a treatment if it's not being compared to something else.
I'll point out that Dr. Susan Modisett is the director of the Gynecologic Oncology Division at the University of Virginia Health System and co-director of the High-Risk Breast Ovarian Cancer Clinic and a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UVA. Here she is performing surgeries, researching cancer, and teaching. She wears many, many hats. Now we have a call from David from Hampton. Hi, David. You're on the air, and I know you have another question for the doctor.
Yes, my name is David Foster. I'm the director of the Hampton Roads Normal Chapter. That's NORML. Stands for the National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws. Israel, Spain, and the U.S. has run a lot of studies on cannabis in curing cancer, and the medical term apoptosis, which redirects the cells that are multiplying crazy to commit suicide into cell death. And I want to know from the doctor's point, her concern or interest or her knowledge on this vast movement that's crossing America for medical cannabis. And also with pediatrics, there's a huge action with children with seizures. The CBD oil extract is eliminating, in this one case, Charlotte's Web is the name of the strain, where she was having 300 seizures a week, and it's down to maybe one a week. Can your doctors comment on medical cannabis?
David, thank you so much for that. And Dr. Modisett, if I might tack on yet another part of that question.
No.
I know. So you can take whichever part you want. You don't have to take the whole thing. However, there is discussion around the legalization of medical marijuana in Virginia.
Right.
And many people point not just to the things that David just suggested, but more specifically around pain management and how many cancer patients suggest that medical marijuana has been very helpful in at least managing that.
Well, I was hopeful David was going to go with either nausea prevention or pain, because that's something I know much more about with regard to
there.
Marijuana. So first of all, I'm not aware of anything in terms of marijuana increasing apoptosis, which, as David points out, is a cell death mechanism. And there are many cancer drugs that work through that final common pathway. That just means the cancer dies as a result of exposure to a chemotherapy, an antibody, any treatment. So I can't speak to that. In terms of ameliorating symptoms for cancer patients, I do think that there could be a role for medical marijuana. For example, there is an anti-nausea drug, I think the trade name is Marinol, which actually uses an extract of marijuana for nausea. And it's a very old drug and has been around a long time. And I think that there are a lot of good evidence to support medical marijuana in terms of nausea reduction and symptom relief. So I would be supportive of that being legalized under controlled circumstances for medical uses. Remember, I'm speaking for myself, not for UVA. I don't want to get anyone in trouble.
Sure, but as a cancer researcher, there is merit.
Yes, I know more about the symptom release. I can't speak. I'd have to actually go online. Maybe I would talk to Anne about trying to find out more about the actual therapeutic benefits of marijuana.
Right. Anne, do you get this question?
Well, I haven't had it so far, but I wouldn't be surprised that I will now. Mm-hmm. And certainly, there is lots of research available, and there's lots being written. But once again, going back to those reliable resources would be much more dependable.
We're talking with Anne Dusing with the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia and Dr. Susan Modisett, professor and cancer researcher at the University of Virginia. And you're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Many more of you have called in, and we have you on hold. We'll be sure to come to your calls after this break. This reminder that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. And find out about upcoming topics and comment on past ones on Facebook. Search for Virginia Conversations and like us. We have many websites we're referring to on this program. You can find all of those websites reprinted at the virginiapublicradio.org website for Virginia Conversations. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Maylily Lee with Virginia Conversations. Today, we're talking about personalized medicine as it relates to cancer care. Joining us from her office in Charlottesville is Dr. Susan Modisett. She is the director of the Gynecologic Oncology Division at the University of Virginia Health System. She's co-director of the High-Risk Breast Ovarian Cancer Clinic and a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UVA. And she's a Cavalier. She graduated UVA. And also joining us in our Richmond studio is Anne Dusing. She's the treatment team chair of the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia, as well as the outreach librarian of the UVA Health Sciences Library based at UVA's College in Wise. Bet you didn't think that you could call a librarian or contact one through email or web and get information about cancer. All the information we provide on this show you can find at virginiapublicradio.org at the Virginia Conversations website. Now, Dr. Modisett, if we could, I'd like to utilize your knowledge around breast cancer and ovarian cancer to provide some insight, because it is true that ovarian cancer does not get the attention that breast cancer gets, with some 200,000 breast cancer patients versus some 25,000 ovarian cancer patients.
Yeah, and it's appropriate. I mean, obviously it affects less women, but it is far more deadly. And, you know, so it's one of those things I think one of the prior callers talked about, his aunt looking up things on the web and almost deciding not to undergo treatment because she found the results were so dismal, but then had a great outcome going on some new drugs. And I think some people look at ovarian cancer and say the same thing, that we do a great job treating folks and we get most people into remission, but unfortunately many women and most women will end up passing away from their disease. And so it really highlights the role of clinical trials in trying to foster better treatments for it. You know, 1% of American women will develop ovarian cancer in their lifetime. So it's still a relatively uncommon disease, thank goodness.
But what concerns me is how fatal it is, mm-hmm. and also how undetectable. And it doesn't seem like there are enough sort of protocols in place when a person is getting a gynecological exam to screen for ovarian cancer.
Oh, if I could develop an effective ovarian cancer screening protocol, I would be so happy. It's been the holy grail of GYN oncology for years and years, because we do know if women are lucky enough to be diagnosed in stage one, meaning the cancer is confined to the place of origin, that the cure rate is 90%, versus most women are found in advanced stages, stage three and four, where the cancer has spread throughout the abdomen or even to the lungs, and those women's five-year survival rate is really around 30%, and cure rate's probably around 10% of women that will actually be cured of their disease. And so that becomes very difficult. And so the idea is, well, if we found everybody at stage one, we'd have great cure rates. Well, unlike breast cancer, which tends to start as a small area and then grow and then spread, where we have very effective screening with mammograms and things like that, ovarian cancer, we actually are starting to figure out that perhaps ovarian cancer doesn't always start in the ovary. It may start as small cells that are abnormal in the fallopian tube, which then these cells kind of get out all over into the abdomen, kind of like little grains of sand that kind of seed over the surfaces of the intestines and the things in the abdomen, and then they're so small we can't see them, and then they grow up all together. So by the time we find it and can detect it, it's already spread and it's already grown. And so the things that we have for ovarian cancer screening that we've been testing in trials, which are ultrasounds to look at the ovaries, or a blood marker called a CA125, or any other blood marker. We looked at every one that can possibly be imagined almost for ovarian cancer screening, and just haven't found something that has been super effective in finding these early cancers. And again, it may be because the disease process isn't what we thought it was.
I'd like you to keep your researcher cap on and tell us a little bit about cancer treatments, beginning with cell research, then animals, and then humans.
Thanks. It's in my career, I've done really well curing ovarian cancer, particularly in cells and mice. And then the sticking point becomes when you get to people, because people are surprisingly a little bit more complex than mice. And so they have a lot of different avenues that you have to explore. And so you can try these new cancer drugs in cells, they work great. Then you go to mice, they work great. And then you go to people, and they don't work great, or they have unanticipated side effects. And so that's the hard part. If you look at the number of compounds in clinical trials now for cancer, it's probably over 8,000, but very, very few of them will make it all the way through to clinical trials, and then less than 5% of all will ever make it into our armamentarium to fight cancer. So it's a long, laborious process, and with very few wins at the end, and a lot of work that goes into trying to figure out how it works.
Let's go now to Chatham. We have a call from Carol, a cancer survivor who was treated at UVA. Hi, Carol.
Hi. How are you?
Did you have any interaction? Probably not. This is one of those long shots like, oh, you're from Norfolk? I am too. Do you know such and such? However, did you have any connection with Dr. Modisett over at UVA?
Dr. who?
Dr. Modisett?
No, I am so old, and I've been going there so long, that my initial physicians were Dr. Hanks, Dr. Lynn, and Dr. Sue Meesfeld.
Tell us about your call today. Oh, there you go.
So I'm calling for two reasons. One, to sing the praises of the Cancer Center at UVA. I have been going there since December 2000. I had a radical mastectomy and reconstruction January 4th, 2001. Those are dates that never leave your mind. And I am still going there. I asked them, how long must I come? And they said, as long as you live. So, and I go happily. I am a patient of Dr. Catherine Kent, whom at the GYN, and I would just like to make a comment as to the fact that you're talking about personalized care. I don't know if that's a new terms come and go. I feel I've had personalized care there since 2000. I cannot say enough about the people in the cancer center, as well as, I mean, I've been all over the place. I've been to orthopedics. I've been to dermatology. I've been to GYN. I've been to digestive health. They're very thorough. And had I not gone there after disaster locally, I probably would not be talking to you.
What a story.
It's people say to me, you go all the way to Charlottesville? And I say, yes, it's worth every mile I drive. But the second question I have has to do with the librarian. I am involved in our local public library, and there is a program from VCU that is now in some of the local libraries, cancer information. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I'm aware that it exists. It's through
their
Massey Cancer Center.
Does UVA have anything? Are we in their catchment area? I don't know how all that works, because I'm very interested in getting as much information as we can into the library.
Great, Carol. We'll let Ann answer that, and we'll say goodbye to you and take the answer offline.
Okay.
UVA does not have a generalized program that's out in the public libraries. In my role in outreach, I've worked with and trained public librarians in southwestern Virginia and further up 81 in utilizing resources to provide health information. And our outreach program is always available to those systems and to the individuals throughout western and southwestern and central Virginia. But no, we do not have the same program.
We go now to Norfolk. And Michaela, good morning, Michaela.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a question. I'm a young 26-year-old who has a very high family history of breast cancer. My mother had it, my grandmother had it, all before age 50, my aunt as well, all deceased from it. And I went ahead and had the BRCA testing. And it came out negative. However, it came back with a result of a mutation of unknown significance. And the doctors that did my testing pretty much just said I was fine, that it was all good and everything was good, and sent me on my way. However, that was about 2 years ago, and when I went in to get a new form of birth control from a new OBGYN, they were very, very alarmed by this. They thought that I had not received enough testing, that there was a lot more that could be done, that I was still, you know, extremely high risk, and that I should be having a lot more testing a lot earlier on, you know, even starting, you know, as soon as now, as far as my mammograms and my MRIs. And I was just very confused by this, and I didn't know, I just wasn't sure, you know, how to take that.
All right, we'll take that answer from Dr. Modisett, and thank you so much for calling in. All right, Susan, what's your thought?
Yeah. Oh, okay. So first of all, we look at her family, and that is clearly something hereditary, okay, for breast cancer. But only half of the hereditary breast cancers are caused by mutations in the BRCA1 and 2 genes. So the problem is that we weren't able to test the women in her family to see if they carried that mutation. That's the ideal place to start, is with the cancer patient to see if they carry the mutation, because we each have two copies of every gene. So the two situations would be either the family had a mutation and the caller did not inherit it, which would mean she's at normal risk, the risk we all have for developing breast cancer, or there is a different mutation in the family and we don't know what it is and we have to treat her as high risk. So I would still consider her very high risk, and need to have some personalized therapy in terms of discussing whether or not we do need to add in breast MRIs, at what age, is there other testing we can do. I will mention what she called a variant of uncertain significance. What that means is that there's something different about her gene, but we don't have enough data about that particular difference to know if it's just something like benign, like a difference in your hair color, your gene's a little different, versus a difference that can cause cancer.
Okay. We have another question for you, this one from Renee from Hampton. And it it dovetails what we were just discussing earlier around remission rates. How long is that timeline? And Renee has some questions around that. Is this for yourself or for a loved one? Hi, Renee. You're on the air. Hi, Renee. Okay, I'm going to speak on behalf. Oh, there we go. I was about to speak on your behalf.
Okay. My question is for my 45-year-old brother who has an intellectual disability. He was born mentally retarded. And I care for him and my 90-year-old mother. And anyway, he had leukemia when he was 14. He's been in remission for years. But my question is, how long does remission last? Because my mother, who was his caregiver until I moved him in with me about 2 years ago, is still thinking that, you know, she's overprotective, and she thinks that any minute he may, you know, the cancer may come back. So my question is, how long does remission last? Is this an indefinite? He doesn't go to VCU anymore. That's when he started his treatments. He had bone marrow treatments, radiation treatments, so forth, when he was 14.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that call. We'll take that answer with Dr. Modisett.
So it's different for every type of cancer. For example, for kind of fast-growing, aggressive cancers, you know, as one of the previous doctors talked about breast cancer, if people haven't recurred within 5 years, we assume that they're in remission and actually cured, that it won't come back. Then there's some slow-growing breast cancers that can come back after 10 or even 15 years. So it really depends on which type of cancer. But if he's 45 and had leukemia at 14, he's cured of that cancer. The question would be, is he at higher risk for developing a second cancer? Because once you've had one cancer, there could be factors that would influence whether you get a second cancer. Sometimes that's treatment. For example, if you had radiation, there are secondary malignancies that can happen because of the high-dose radiation, you know, 20 and 30 years after the treatment. Same things with some of the chemotherapies as well. So unfortunately, we can sometimes cure a cancer but cause a later cancer down the road.
Dr. Modisett, earlier we put you out on that ledge to talk about medical marijuana.
Great.
And you disavowed any association with UVA while you did it. That was great.
I didn't want to get in trouble.
Right, exactly. You're like Galileo, only you're probably not going to pay the ultimate price.
Right.
So one more, and that will be around your studies. You focus on breast cancer. You focus on ovarian cancer. You're in a field that is largely male-dominated. Do you find that there is inherent sexism in cancer research?
I'm lucky. I've never perceived that. And maybe it's because the field I've been in, maybe it's just me. And luckily, I take care of only women, so all of our trials have enough women in them. We're focused on women. Now, where women have gotten a little bit less play is in cancers that are not even just cancer, but in clinical trials where it's a disease that affects both men and women. Women can sometimes be underrepresented in the study population, and that's something that, for example, the National Cancer Institute looks at very closely in monitoring trials. But so I think that there have not been historically enough women in the trials themselves as subjects, and probably not enough women yet running the trials, but I think those things are changing for the better. For example, my field was 70 to 80% men, and now if you look at the incoming fellows in GYN oncology, it's 80% women.
All right, good to know. And let's go ahead and touch base on all of these points. We want to turn first to our in-house librarian, Ann Dusing, as we round out this show. You are the treatment team chair of the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia. Can you give us one more time the website?
Yes, it's cancercoalitionofvirginia.org. And if you lose that or don't write it down, just Google it and you will find us readily on the webpage.
And the email where people can contact you as a health sciences librarian?
Is cad4n@virginiaspelledout.edu.
And finally, Susan, clinicaltrials.gov, you highly recommend this website.
Correct. If they have cancer, one of their family members have cancer, it's a good place to look for clinical trials. And it's one of the things you have to look at it and then talk to your physician because you may not know for sure based on the website whether you would qualify or not. But that, the National Cancer Institute has great website in terms of a reputable place from my standpoint for patients to look for information about their cancer, about looking at treatments. So I actually just got on their website to look up the medical marijuana question. It's things that we use as clinicians as well.
And this is important to access because too often people turn to Time or USA Today and they see a big, bold statement, you know, treatment for melanoma. And then all of a sudden, people with different kinds of cancers get this false hope.
Right. And there's also a lot of direct-to-consumer advertising, which drives me
nuts.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a nice way of putting it. Which, again, great products sometimes, but, again, marketed to the patients. For example, just recommending everyone get BRCA testing. Well, as we learned with that other caller, that is helpful but not definitive, and most women with breast cancer would never have a positive BRCA test. So some women might falsely be told that they're not at risk when they are. So those are things we have to think about.
Such important information. We want to thank both of our guests, Dr. Susan Modisett, cancer researcher and professor at UVA, and Ann Dusing, treatment team chair of the Cancer Action Coalition of Virginia. You've been listening to Virginia Conversations. I'm Maylily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.